This started. Okay.
So yeah, my family, the Winslows on my dad's side, came here in the 1840s, I believe. I think my great-great-grandfather was a teacher in Clark Township, but then ended up here. He was the he wasn't the oldest son, so he didn't inherit the estate over there. And when I was in Ireland at one point, I found the will of his father. And he said that George, being of sufficient means, will not be getting anything, kind of thing. And but he came over here. His wife's name was Mary Forster. She was supposed to be some kind of lady-in-waiting at the court, at the royal court or something. Anyway, he came over here, and I don't think he was particularly good at farming. And I've heard stories that, this is Millbrook society in the 1840s, mm-hmm. right? That it was kind of modeled itself on the old country a bit. So they'd have dances and balls and things like that, and it had hunting dogs and trying to live a lifestyle that would have been more appropriate maybe where they came from than here. Mm-hmm. He had many children, or his wife had, Mary had many children, and the oldest one's name was Blaney. And I understand, again, this is all oral legend, that he had a little bit of a problem with, you know, drinking and stuff. And at a certain point, the farm was sold to his brother Charles. That would be my great-grandfather's brother. Now, Charles Winslow is interesting because he was a young soldier in the Fenian Uprising in 1866. And in 1885, during the Second Riel Resistance in Saskatchewan, he was captain of a company from Millbrook that went out as part of the Midland Battalion to fight against Louis Riel. In the process of doing this, the soldiers, three of his privates, McCory and Stainthorpe and Natris, stole or took or lifted, as war booty they called it, a blessed Catholic church bell from the little community of Frog Lake, just in the border of what's now Saskatchewan and Alberta. They brought that bell, had been blessed by Bishop Grandin from Quebec, and they brought that bell back to Millbrook and presented it to the fire department. It was put up in the fire hall in Millbrook. It was used for years as a fire bell till the old fire hall tower burnt. The bell cracked and fell to the ground, and the Corey guy grabbed it up, tried to repair it, couldn't repair it, and then they hung it up in the old fire hall, the hose tower, and eventually it was put in the Millbrook Legion on display with some war medals from 1885. And eventually in 1991, several Métis people from out west visited the Legion, and the bell was taken back, repatriated, they say. Then about 15 years ago, in the early 2000s, they discovered where it was in Winnipeg, and eventually came out, and it's in a museum in Winnipeg now. So that's kind of an interesting sidebar to history of that time. Mm-hmm. Charles had a son named Arthur, and he was a World War I veteran. Arthur had got this farm from Charles, so that would again be my great-grandfather's brother's son. I don't know what that would be to me. But my grandfather, for some reason, this great-grandfather's son, Fred, he wanted to get this farm. So he bought it from, I guess it would have been his cousin Arthur, and just after the First World War in 1918. And him and my dad, who was born in 1908, and my grandpa were very poor farmers, and they ended up paying off this farm in the 1930s, getting the full deed to it. And so I came along in 52, and by that time my grandfather died when I was 2 years old. My dad's farming, he's a farmer, and I grew up on this farm working with my parents, and my dad and mom were market gardeners. So we grew vegetables. Oh. We grew cabbages and tomatoes and corn and all these fields. The fields over there, the fields up there, mm-hmm. they were all gardens. And we had cattle, and we had grain, and we had hay. We didn't... horses were gone by the time I came along. It's what they call mixed farming, you know. Okay. And at that time, I remember it's Claire Winslow again and Harry McCamus saying, at one time there were 12 farms on this line, 12 different families raising their families on farms, and now there's one. So if you look now, most farms have become larger. So there may be smaller packets, but a farmer like the Stevens family, they'll rent several farms. Yeah. And that's how you survive. You see the big machines rolling around the country these days, right? Yeah. The seeders and the planters and stuff. But I grew up in that, excuse me, I guess it was kind of the tail end of that small family farm culture, which was pretty cool because up in Lauger Drive here, there were the Hudson family, the Elgar family, the Armstrong family, the McDowell family, the Hubbard family, and we were all neighbors. People would drop in, like you drop, like, I knew you were coming today, but people would hear, just drop in. How are you doing today? You know, and people would help each other with manure bees and, well, back early before my time, threshing bees. But there was kind of a mutual help kind of vibe that existed in the country. And I knew all their kids and I was friends with them. And it was an old saying, you can live without your friends, but not without your neighbors. And I kind of grew up in that environment.
Can I ask you to stop for just a second? Yeah. So I just want to make sure this is actually
Yeah, see if it's going. See if it's going there.
Start again.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah, it should be good to go.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the Winslows. And when I created the play, The Winslows of Derrivore, I got a an Arts B grant from the Canada Council in 1993. And I went over to Ireland. Before that, I'd researched my Cavan Blazers play in Ireland in 86. But I got this grant in 93 to go over and dig into the Winslow family. What were they doing before they came here? Mm-hmm. So I was able to trace them back to 1607 and coming to Ireland as part of the plantations of Ulster at the same time as the American colonies were being settled. And find out George Winslow was the first one. Guy Winslow. George Winslow was my great-great-grandfather. Guy Winslow was the first one. And he came from Devon, like I said, somewhere. I went to Devon to see if I could find out where he came from. Barnstaple in the north, but I'm not sure if that's exactly where he came from. Anyway, they had some property in a townland called Derrivore, right on a trial bay, it was called, the body of water, connected to part of Loch Aaron. And they just plopped down, and there were all these Irish around them. And then in 1641, the Irish rose up against the English colonizers. And his son, Thomas, was actually captured by the rebels and was taken prisoner and made a cook. And he witnessed these various massacres at Tully Castle and Castle Monet and different places. And then he testified at these hearings, called the Black Books, I think they called them, in 1643. And then he got his property back. And things went on down, generation after generation on the same kind of area in Fermanagh County, which is part of the north now. And then my great-great-grandfather came here with his wife around 1840-something. Yeah. It was great being in Ireland. I still feel a real connection to it. When I researched the Cavan Blazers, it was more that it wasn't a family story. It was about this community. So I really did a lot of digging in the various areas where the people that came to Cavan come from, particularly the Protestants that came from County Wexford, south of Dublin. And they had terrible experiences. And when they came to Cavan, they sort of vowed they would never have any Catholics around them again. And when all these Peter Robinson Catholics ended up on their doorstep, then things started to deconstruct.
Yeah. You kind of hope that, you know, what they're coming from, they don't bring with them.
Yeah, and they did. They totally did. And I mean, it's funny because we've done that play 7 times. We did it in 92, 93, 96, 2001, 2011, and 2023, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's the one we saw.
The themes keep being relevant. I don't know whether it's because there's different parts of the world. Like when I first did the play in 92, everything was happening in Yugoslavia with the ethnic cleansing and stuff. And then it seems like there's always something going on in the world that I think people could read. I think in 23 it might have been an Israeli Arab thing going on. But so it has themes that seem to stick because there is that age-old conflict, you know, and doesn't seem to change that much.
No, unfortunately. No.
Yeah. Although the younger generation now, I would assume, is a lot more sensitive to so many things. But you never know. You never know what can happen in the world. No. I mean, it's not like ideal in the States right now. It's not ideal in the world right now.
No, it isn't. Well, even here, we have our own issues as well.
Yeah.
Too. So.
Yeah.
So, then. So you have so much history that you, I don't know how you remember all of this.
Well, it's only because it's ingrained. You know, I wouldn't be as good at what happened yesterday, and I do crosswords all the time, but it's all ingrained in there because I spent so much time doing it. Because typically doing a play would take me 3 to 5 years of work. Mm-hmm. So it gets pretty ingrained.
Okay.
And I would talk about the stuff as well, so that helps ingrain it. But you're right, I don't know where it's coming from, but it's in there.
What came first? So you obviously have a love of history.
Yeah, I didn't really like history that much. I won't tell my high school principal, because he was a history teacher, and I'm doing a play about my old high school, but I don't recall really, really loving history that much when I was in high school. But people did tell me that I talked about wanting to do a play about the local history even back then. I don't remember that. So I don't know when it started coming to me. Obviously, because I started, you know, in my 20s, I wanted to be a theater person all my life, but from time of being a kid, but I never had the real opportunity, or it was nothing my family or thought was a realistic goal for me. Mm-hmm. So somehow I backed into it through local community theater in the early, in mid to late 1970s and early 1980s, and I ended up becoming a professional actor. But at the same time, I was working on The Cabin Blazer, so my interest in history and writing was going on at that time, but I really cut my teeth as an actor. And then later, as a director of a company, and I did a lot of acting out west in Western Canada, Edmonton, Calgary, Vancouver, and a bit in Toronto. But then I started directing, and I started a company called East City Productions in Peterborough in the mid-1980s. And then I was part of a theater collective called The Union, and we took over a space on Hunter Street in Peterborough. We ran a soup kitchen. We programmed all sorts of stuff out of there. I learned how to sort of run something, because mm-hmm. my dad was kind of a business person, because he had that side of it. And then I had this play I've been working on for a long time, The Blazers, and finally I had an opportunity to maybe do it. And I had this sort of, I don't know, epiphany or whatever it was, eureka moment. I'd done a show out west at the Edmonton Fringe, and I came in 91, and I came back here, and I looked out in the fields, and I saw scenes from the play, and I said, I'm going to do that here on okay. this farm. And the farm was not equipped to be a theater at all. Buildings were all falling down. Everything was overgrown. There was old machinery and all the art. Like, everything was it was a disaster. My old 63 Chevy Bel Air was sitting out there, you know, rotting. And somehow because I'd done the work in Peterborough with starting companies and stuff, and I worked with a lot of artists from the time I was in my mid-20s, I sort of had a community that I could sort of say, hey, guys, do you want to, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Let's put on a show. It's that old Mickey Rooney, whatever thing, in a barnyard kind of thing, or Field of Dreams or whatever. So that happened. And then, you know, we had a play which was very successful. Like, the CBC Journal did a piece on it. It got so much. It's a great piece of video on it. It was done in 92, just before the Journal ended. Mark, what's his name?
Starwitz,
yeah.
That's my neighbor.
Yeah, there you go. Well, he produced it. He produced that documentary. So ask him about it if you ever see him. He was very helpful. Great guy. And then we said, what are we going to do now? So we said, well, what are we going to write a play about now? So we learned Susanna Moody and Catherine Partrail lived in the area, so we created a play about them. We did it in the woods at the back of the farm. What are we going to do now? Oh, there's a local guy's written. I went to a historical society to do a talk. A local guy's written a play about this guy called Farini, who walked over a high wire at Niagara Falls in the 1860s against Blondin and invented all these things and came from Port Hope. Local guy. Okay, Shane Peacock, who wrote the nonfictional book about him, wrote a play about him for us. And we started commissioning writers to write. I was writing. We wrote a play about the local farm community called The Farm Show. I did a play based on a local doctor and his telephone operator, because doctors are the ones that started the telephones. The Crow Hill, one of my favorites. And it just kind of snowballed. And then one about Bernardo Chill. Like, there's been a lot. I think I've done maybe 17 or 18. Mm-hmm. And when they all take 3 years each, that doesn't make sense, but there's a lot of overlaps. Yeah. Right at the moment, I'm working on two, so, and two other ideas kind of coming, so it fills your time completely. So, yeah, so my love of history was very much connected to being able to animate history and put it in with people in costume in the open air. And I spent so many years rehearsing in little dingy, dark bad air places in various parts of Canada. And I said, if I ever have a theater, I want it to be in the open air. Mm-hmm. I want people to breathe the air and be outside and experience nature and stuff. So that's where the idea came from. I'd done also something in the mid-80s for Murray Schafer, The Greatest Show on Earth, it was called, and I played the Sambalupi Ringmaster, and mm-hmm. that was done in the old Crary Park in Peterborough. And that was a big deal. He had artists from all over the world in that production. So I'd learned a bit about what's like to do stuff outdoors. I'd worked in Edmonton for a few years, and I worked for companies that did all new Canadian work, like Theatre Network, Northern Light, the Edmonton Fringe, Workshop West. So I was around people and writers writing new work. So I had the playwriting stuff going. Mm-hmm. I had the outdoor vibe going. I had the directing going from what I did with East City Productions. And it was an improv company, so I learned about improv. And so I had these various, and then running a space, the union, having to pay the rent every month. How are you going to make a go? We were just really poor. We did a play once called Frankenstein Meets the Recession in 1991. Everybody was so poor. It was about homelessness, and it was about single moms. Anyway, there were all these different little pockets of things, because I was never really trained. I never went to theater school. So okay. I did a undergraduate degree at University of Toronto, and my major was philosophy and English. That's where I'm from. So all these little pockets of experience, and then when it came together, I guess I would have been like maybe 38 or 39. My mom had died in 1990 when I was 37, I think. My dad had died in 75 when I was 22. So when my mom died in 90, I had to make a decision about what to do with this property. And I had been doing theater for a while, so it was that was kind of the eureka moment. Okay, if we do something here, like a play, maybe I can stay here. Maybe I can pay the taxes. Maybe I can afford to live here. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had a full-time salary for about 10 years after that, but it was a way to keep the farm, for sure. And then my parents were both gone, so a lot of people would say to me, oh, your parents would be so proud. They never saw any of this, which is kind of a bit of a regret, but I don't mind it because my mother was a very sociable person. She was one of six sisters, grew up in Fraserville, and really outgoing person. And she would have liked the fact that there are all these people enjoying the place.
Did your parents ever see you act?
My mom saw me act. She saw me do a couple of the television dramas too, which was nice in the mid-80s. My dad didn't. My dad was long gone. But my mom saw me starting out as an actor. And I think she might have even seen an early draft of the Cavan Blazers.
Okay.
You know? So, and she hung on. She wasn't that well. She died pretty young, 71, younger than I am now. But she hung on to this farm in spite of that. And I don't know whether she had some kind of an instinct of spidey sense that something good mm-hmm. could happen here. Because now the theater's been here. There's a couple of weird things for me in my memory, like I'm doing this Millbrook High School play. I've been here, the theater's been around longer than Millbrook High School was around, which is, okay. Can't believe that. Also, I've been here longer now, uninterrupted, than my dad was here, because they got the farm after the First World War. My dad died in 75. So if I add those years and I look at the years of 52 to now, I've been actually here longer than my dad was here, and much longer than my parents. But they were married in 44, so...
When did you start expanding so that you've got the barns for staging and you've got areas for audience and things like that?
Those were all original barns.
Okay.
Yeah, they were all here. They just happened, again, kismet, luck. They were like a horseshoe open to the south. The road's that way, so mm-hmm. sound is kept away. Mm-hmm. The wind, most of the winds are kind of kept away because in the winter you get a lot, in the summer and winter you get a lot of west winds and stuff. So it was just like magical that it was set up like that, where all the audience sits now. That was a barn that was gutted, and then the seats were built into okay. that. There's two bleachers there that were obviously built, and all the barns where there's the parapet and where the actors come out of, those were all original barns as well. That's okay. where the cattle was and the granary was and the haylofts and all that stuff. So it was weird. The first maybe 10 years of the company, I kept thinking of it being a farm. Like I'd see the plays, but I keep thinking of my parents and my neighbors and all the things were done. People would come and say, oh yeah, I helped your dad clean that barn out, or I helped your dad build that little buttress or something. And then it eventually shifted. Now people think of it as a theater. I don't think most people even know that I exist or that I live here. I mean, people, when I first started the theater, I would know 50, 60, 70% of the audience. I would know those okay. people. And now I know hardly anybody because it's expanded and people come from all over. Yeah. And they don't know what the history of this farm is or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's still called the Winslow Farm, which I'm glad the company does that, because that's kind of at least a bit of a nod to the heritage of the place, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. And I think, you know, that bringing history to life's a great thing. I think it's a great aim, especially local history, which isn't known that well. But I think the experience of being here in the outdoors and the old farm is really important to our audience as well. So if the theater was to say go somewhere else, then I'm not sure what the feel would be. Like, was it an indoor space like in Peterborough, like say, what would it still be that fourth line feel? I don't know. And of course, you think you're going to live forever, and you think, well, but we've made some steps towards the idea that potentially, possibly, Fourth Line could continue and the farm could continue as a public space. I'd like to see that. Mm-hmm. I don't have kids.
Are you an only child as well?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And
Even just the fact that you're able to incorporate so much of the actual outdoor space as well in your production.
Yeah, I don't like denying it. I like to embrace it. So yeah, the fields, the people coming in from the fields, and I'm when I do plays, my sets are usually very, very sparse. Mm-hmm. And like other directors are different. They want a lot of stuff, which is fine too. But I always, it started for me with the idea of the barnyard and the idea of the old farm feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot, like when I did the Bernardo Chilton play, I don't think we had any set. Did you see that one?
No, it's the first one we had heard about when we had just moved here.
I think the last time we did it was maybe in 2014 or something. But it was a big success because there were so many children that came from Britain in those programs for immigration programs, especially Bernardo children. There's a lady named Ivy Susie. I think she's still with us, and she has a group called the Bernardo Hazelbrig Group in Peterborough and Casebo. 10,000 girls went through that home up in Bernardo Avenue. That's named after Dr. Mm-hmm. Bernardo. And I met with so many people that had been Bernardo children and talked to them and to their kids if they were gone. And when we did that play, it was sold out before it opened. And we were running it 5 weeks, 5 nights a week. It was sort of like Wild Irish Geese. It was sold. And then we brought it back the next year, and the same thing happened. It was one of those stories that it was like under the surface, and people hadn't talked that much about it, but so many people could connect to it because of their heritage.
Yeah, my husband's grandmother and her brother were Bernardo children.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Every family has something like that, right?
Yeah.
And you it's like the Wild Irish Geese. You spread that out to all those people that came in mm-hmm. 1825 and all their descendants. It's massive. Yeah. I love that. I love that communion between an audience and those stories. And we did the Blazers at first, you know, you have the people that were on the Catholic side, people on the Protestant side sitting in the audience. It's almost like there's a play going on in the audience as well. But, I always wanted to do theater that was kind of relevant. And there's different ways to be relevant, obviously. And maybe if I had lived in a city where I could do whatever, it didn't really matter. You could tell darker stories maybe. And of course, Blazers had darker elements mm-hmm. because a lot of history is dark. But I really think the essence of what Fourth Line does is a kind of important part of it, is that capturing of local community stories for the community. So it's by the community, with the community, for the community. And there's a kind of circle there that, because our stories are how we know about who we are. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how we have our own stories. We have our family stories. We have our community stories. They're kind of a way to kind of get through things in a way, to get through life in a way. And even in like an indigenous culture where people pass stories down for the value of those stories to the people now. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a good project. And I think that's why it's lasted as long as it has, is... and not, you know, just kind of burn itself out. Mm-hmm. Also, we worked on Succession. So Kim, who's now the artistic director, she worked for the company for years before that. And, you know, as people get older, they have less energy. So you need younger people with more energy. And mm-hmm. it's all about energy, really, ultimately. I was thinking about life. I'm a big hockey fan. So I'm a big Habs fan. So it's just, I was so happy last night.
Oh, are they still in?
Oh God Almighty! They're in the conference final. They won their first game last night. Okay. So, but it's energy. So when you're young, like I couldn't have, when I started the theater and when I was 37 or 8, the energy I had to do that, to retain all those things that I've just been spewing to you, that's what it is. It's energy. And then when you get older, you don't have the same. So you have to find ways to, hey.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm just going to start loading the van. It'll take me.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
No rush.
Jeanette's a potter, so Jeanette's moving her pottery stuff to a different location because the theater takes over the studio in the summer.
It's nice that you mentioned earlier about the indigenous, the oral storytelling that goes from generation to generation. And I think a lot of us regret not having picked up those family histories from previous generations. Like, I regret not asking my grandmother
more
about family and that kind of
thing. Oh, my God, my grandmother. My grandmother was born in 1888. Yeah. I never for a second ever thought of asking her anything about her life. And think of what she went through.
Yeah.
You know, and my dad was born in 1908. Same with him. I never remember sitting down with my dad and asking him anything. Yeah. So, and I've. It's kind of ironic, but like one of our board members used to say, "You're more obsessed with other people's past than your own." So, I know a lot about a lot of stories from this area. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm trying to say, I was at a interment the other day at Perrytown Church. I'd never been there in my life. What a beautiful little church. You know where County Road 10, you're going down towards Coburg and up in the hill there, that beautiful stone church.
I have driven by that.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. That's an Anglican church. One of our board members from the 1990s who was a professor of microbiologist at London, got early onset dementia and early onset Parkinson's and passed away younger than me, and it was an interment, and he was a nephew of the woman that we based the telephone play Crow Hill on. And I went there to that interment, and I went in for coffee and, you know, sandwiches after, and these three gentlemen sat down beside me, and one guy's 94, one guy's 91, and they started telling me stories that they wanted me to know about that area.
Yeah.
About this one man named Wilbur Gilmore. Not Wilbert, Wilbur Gilmore, who'd planted trees on his farm, and when those trees were big enough, he built his house with them.
Oh.
And he thought, what a story that this guy took that time to do something, you know?
Yeah.
And they told me different stories about the train going through and different things about the Second World War, but I just soaked that stuff up. It's great.
Yeah. Anyway, you need to go on thinking.
No, right? Not at all. I don't know what Jeanette wanted to ask me, but she didn't ask me, so no, I'm good.
Okay.
I'm good. I'll find out later what it was.
Well, maybe we stop.
Yeah.
Are we good for the Winslows?
Yeah.